This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In just a few minutes, we will talk with Alan Weissman, author of the global bestsellers, The World Without Us and Countdown. But first, a few snapshots you might have missed. During a pandemic of fear and disease, while millions wonder where the rent or mortgage payments will come from, all of it played out on a stage of extreme weather. Over the decades, climate change has been building. In the Northern Hemisphere summer of 2020, it showed up. The headlines rolled in almost as fast as Trump's tweets. Extremely hot summers now happen 200 times more often than 50 years ago, writes Dan Miller in the Daily Kos, July 10th. Dan is drawing on an updated bell curve paper from Uber climate scientist James Hansen. Maybe that explains some of the crazy heat around the Northern Hemisphere. Even Fox News reports heat wave in Europe sets temperature records in Spain. London sees UK's third hottest day. Forecasters said the heat wave was fueled by hot air coming northward from Africa, end quote. That was on August 2nd. London sweltered under a heat wave for the first 2 weeks of August, and Britons are not used to that. A study a few years ago found less than 1% of UK homes have air conditioning. Or how about this one from Fox News on July 29th? Heat wave roasts Washington, D.C., breaks record for most 90-degree days in the month. Day after day, it was sweaty hot, 32 degrees C, and that is the future. Now, if Fox News would just connect the dots to our greenhouse gas emissions heating up the planet, it's called climate change. Real foxes know that. And they are heading higher up in the hills or further north when they can't survive at all. That was a truly historic and hemispheric heat wave that hit us this past summer. In Canada's far north Bathurst Inlet, along waters just around the Arctic Circle, on August 3rd, the temperature reached 91 degrees Fahrenheit, 32.7 C. That kind of tropical heat just does not happen there. In the world you grew up in, that never happened. On August 6th, Reuters reports Canada's last fully intact Arctic ice shelf collapses. On the far north giant Ellesmere Island, the Milne ice sheet lost, quote, more than 40% of its area in just 2 days at the end of July. In any other time, just this event alone should be seen as headline news. And on any other planet, it would be a hot topic if they had talk shows and if they had elections. Giant masses of Arctic ice are falling into the sea. This is a climate alarm bell and warning for every city built on the ocean. Rising seas are not a hoax. But ice is disappearing everywhere, from Tibet, well, on the UK Guardian website on August 6th it reported Italian homes evacuated over the risk of Mont Blanc glacier collapse. AP's Seth Borenson reports August 20th on New Science showing record melt. Greenland lost 586 billion tons of ice in 2019. That is almost double the average ice loss just since 2003. We will lose even more in 2020. I have some guests coming up on Radio EcoShock to report on the mass loss of glaciers. The cryosphere is dying, folks. The poles are melting. And there are still people arguing that climate change is not real. The Washington Post headlines, record Arctic blazes may herald new fire regime decades sooner than anticipated. The fires in Siberia started as the snow melted and then sent smoke around the Northern Hemisphere. I covered that with EU scientist Mark Parrington in our June 10th show. Find that at ecoshock.org. Now we learn the carbon dioxide pouring into the atmosphere from a record Arctic fire season released 35% more CO2 into the air by the start of August 2020 than it did in the whole of 2019, which was a very active fire year. Some of that carbon dioxide will be slowly recaptured by growing trees over the coming decades, but all of that burst of CO2 is up there now. It is too new to know what that will mean. You can find links to all these stories in my show blog for September 9th, at ecoshock.org. And watch that blog for an announcement about my new ebook, Extreme Heat. I'm publishing transcripts from the best Radio EcoShock interviews, the scientists, physicians, and authors on surviving the coming age of heat. We are going to need that information. Heaven help Americans in the Southwest this year. Take this MSN news headline, a record nobody really wants. Phoenix surpasses most days at or over 110 degrees. Now, at the time that they wrote that article, Phoenix, Arizonians endured 34 days in a row over 110 degrees or 43 degrees C. It got worse. Phoenix hit 50 days in a row over 110. Isn't that wonderful? You can't imagine what that is like unless you have lived through it. People in Darwin, Australia get it. Humans go loco. They get upset easily, sometimes angry, feeling closed in. And that is just from the relentless heat, not the pandemic that is roaring through Arizona at the very same time. Everybody there is armed. We might as well toss in a match of divisive racist politics and see what happens. On August 10th, CNN Weather warns 80 million Americans got excessive heat alerts, with heat records possible over 10 states. From Texas to California and everywhere in between, it was hellishly hot, more than anyone living could remember. The heat poured up into Oregon, Montana, Idaho, and Washington State. If you live in the West, you know what I'm talking about. Now it is September, and it is still really hot here, too hot to work outside during the day. Death Valley, California may have just set a whole new world record for heat. We are not sure because the two previous records may not have been measured accurately enough many years ago. Anyway, 130 degrees Fahrenheit or 54.4 C recorded in California this August is one of the hottest temperatures on Earth. Does that tell us something? Assuming you have not been off-grid in the bush for the last few months, I don't have to tell you about the terrifying fires in California. Millions of people were scurrying around looking for a safe place while choking out in the smoke. Homes burned, and the power went out, cutting off air conditioning during heat that was just like a big blow dryer. The same thing happened to the poor folks in Louisiana when the power stayed out in the sweltering heat after Hurricane Laura blew it all down. Redwood forests in California up to 2,000 years old were invaded by wildfires. The burn scars are so large that from satellites they look like black blobs that ate beautiful parts of California. It hurts me to think about it. And that is more carbon converted from tree trunks and plant matter into CO2 in the atmosphere in this year of 2020. I said this was hemispheric heat. Japan was not left out. In the first week of August, Japan equaled the highest temperatures ever measured there in a heat wave that killed over 26 people in Tokyo alone. And this new heat just keeps on rolling. Going back to our standard for climate reporting, Fox News, we get this headline, Severe Weather Threat for 59 Million, Dangerous Heat for the West Heading into Labor Day Weekend. This summer, my friends, one hot August day, I went out on our front porch. I smelled smoke, and I saw wildfire flames blazing in the trees on a hill just above our house. And that is not at all what you want to see from your front porch. Only 15 minutes later, a water bomber and a bucket helicopter put it out. Now that is a roller coaster of emotions going from, pack the truck, we have to get out, to, ooh, sure glad to see that help arrive, all in less than 15 minutes. And where would we go during a pandemic? The whole summer of 2020 was a horror movie. Let's talk to a wise head about it all. This is Radio EcoShock. Alan Weisman, In Depth, up next.
Goodbye, Radio EcoShock.
In 2007, American author and journalist Alan Weisman wondered how long the creations of human civilization would last if we all disappeared. In his best-selling book, The World Without Us, he suggested, quote, Say a Homo sapiens-specific virus, natural or diabolically nano-engineered, picks us off but leaves everything else intact. And the book goes on from there. As COVID-19 created ghost cities downtown and humans disappeared into their homes, people began to send Alan stories. From his home in Massachusetts, Alan Weissman, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, pleasure to be back with you.
Well, tell us, Alan, what kind of world without us signs are people sending you?
Well, it started with the streets being empty of many cities because people were scared to go outside, or people were being prudent and they were staying inside. They were sheltering. And about the first contacts I began to get were from northern Italy. My book, The World Without Us, was a big bestseller in Italy. It's now out in about 36 languages. And as you may recall, Italy was one of the hardest hit countries by COVID-19. I must have done 7 different interviews with journalists there who talked about how quiet it was and how they could hear the birds singing. And then, of course, we saw reports from Venice of dolphins swimming in the cleared canals because now there was no Vaporetto traffic. As it turned out, those reports were a little exaggerated. There were swans swimming in the canals, and you could see fish because the waters were no longer turbulent. But the dolphins were really superimposed from some footage taken in a Sicilian harbor. I found that actually quite touching because it showed how much people wanted to believe that nature was still around them and was could return very quickly. And what that was all about was something that I talked about in The World Without Us. When people come into contact with nature, something within them, because after all, human nature, you know, half of us is nature, the other half is human civilization, I guess. We just sort of remember this contact that we used to have with plants and animals. And subsequently, I started getting photos of turkeys marching through housing projects in New Jersey or down the streets of suburbs of Chicago, mountain lions in Boulder. All kinds of animal sightings were taking place, and people just were sort of thrilling at that. I'm still doing interviews such as this one. I've done them all over the world, and it's the same talk. I was even on Iranian TV recently. And I think this is one of those things that universally ties us all together. We didn't realize how much we missed our connection with nature until suddenly we were forced into a situation where nature began to creep back into the range of our vision.
Well, just to remind us from the book, if we are gone, won't the great skyscrapers made out of concrete and steel, won't they still reign over any empty cities for a few thousand years as a sign we were here?
Probably not a few thousand years. Some of, you know, archaeology shows us that ruins can persist that long. But back then, we used to make our buildings out of the stuff of the earth itself. You know, particularly stone will last an awful long time. So there's this tower outside of Jericho that is one of the, if not the oldest known human structure. And, you know, it's made out of stones. I mentioned the chapel in New York City. It's right across the street from the Twin Towers that fell, and then that other, I think it was building number 7, that didn't even get hit by a plane, but it fell. And yet St. Paul's didn't even budge because it's made out of the very rock that Manhattan Island is made out of. But when we started building our modern cities, we turned to modern materials that were a lot cheaper, that could be made right on the spot, you know, by mixing sand and cement, rather than having to quarry and drag huge stones, sometimes hundreds of miles, as the ancients did it. And those materials just simply aren't as durable as nature's materials are. Plus, particularly when computers got into the mix, we started calculating the minimum tolerances that we needed to build things so we could build them as cheaply as possible. I have a quote in the book of John Glenn when he's atop the cone of the rocket that's about to thrust him into orbit, the first American to orbit the Earth. And he basically says, "Oh, I'm sitting on top of a pile of low bids." So that's pretty much the way that we build our buildings. And as if to underscore that, the summer that The World Without Us came out, I was on tour and I was giving a talk in Manhattan. And at that talk, attended one of the engineers who helped me research the book. He's a guy who was in charge of several of the bridges that link Manhattan Island to the mainland. And he explained that one of the reasons why bridges that were built 80 years ago can still take much more traffic than the original designers had ever anticipated was because back then, pre-computers, they just heaped on masses and masses of infrastructure in hopes that that would be enough. The week that I gave that talk in Manhattan, a modern bridge in my hometown of Minneapolis, in the interstate highway system that crossed the Mississippi River, collapsed, and tragically a lot of people died. Again, it was one of these ones that were built as a result of a pile of low bids, and that's what a lot of our skyscrapers are. So I don't think that they will stand as long as, say, the pyramids have or some of the ruins of Rome.
Ah, the obituary for the low-bid civilization. So, on Earth Day this year, in a Boston Globe article, you asked, is the coronavirus pandemic Mother Nature's revenge? I don't know if that was the headline writer's caption or yours, but what do you think?
Well, actually, they asked me, and that's the way they titled the piece. And my reply was that, yeah, you might be able to say that, but that's really anthropomorphizing nature. It's something that we tend to do with just about everything. You know, nature doesn't really require some sentient, angry Gaia, you know, to smite us. For one, nature does a lot of smiting all the time. There's this misconception. I see it all the time. You know, I hear about people, you know, wanting to harmonize with nature and get back to, you know, this peaceable kingdom, in as if nature were, you know, that other myth, the Garden of Eden. Nature is like this really violent place. You know, it's a place where big things are always eating smaller things. And I think the way I described it in that article is that nature's balance is this bloody pyramid scheme, but it's one that actually works because you've always got, you know, just masses of little creatures below that are constantly being eaten by fewer but larger and more powerful predators above. The way to think about the human race, though, is, you know, it's not really a race. We're a species. You know, all of our different races are genetically pretty much the same. And like every other species on this planet, throughout nearly all of our natural history, we would die as pretty much as fast as we were being born. I mean, that's nature's rather brutal way of keeping everything in balance. There are prey, there are predators, and there are lifespans, and there are food supplies. You know, if a species grows so numerous that it outstrips its food supply, then its population crashes back. So in my last book, Countdown, I talked about how humanity managed to cheat that. we basically did two things. First of all, we came up with modern medicine, which is not a bad idea. Our life expectancy 200 years ago was only averaged about 40 years, and for any of us who's over 40, such as myself, that's a nice thing. But, you know, we learned, first we came up with a vaccine against smallpox, and then things like pasteurization of milk, the discovery of antiseptics, more vaccines and treatments for diseases that used to knock us off by the thousands and millions even. And gradually, infant mortality went way down and our lifespans went way up, meaning that there were more people on the planet alive. But then what really kicked things off, or just kicked it, you know, into the stratosphere in the 20th century was our discovery of, again, this sounds like a nice idea, growing much more food than nature ever could. First of all, we came up with a way of contributing a necessary nutrient for plant life, nitrogen, to the soil in much greater quantities than those few nitrogen-fixing plants had been able to do before. Because now we learn how to suck it out of the atmosphere, where there's pretty much a limitless supply, by our perspective, of nitrogen, and chemically slather it on the ground. Synthetic nitrogen fertilizer has made such a difference that, I mean, basically, nearly half of us would not exist without it. And then to top that off, in the 60s, we came up with the Green Revolution that took our chief grain plants, corn, rice, wheat, and created varieties with shorter stems so they put more energy into producing more grains. And as a result of all this agricultural advance, our population quadrupled in a single century. And in the history of biology, I don't know of any large animal, a large populous animal, that's ever done anything like that. So now there are just way more of us than there ought to be according to the way that nature works. So eventually nature is still going to require a balance. These are laws of physics, as well as biology. And it's just going to, this isn't necessarily conscious, you know, it just happens due to natural laws. Any vulnerability that we have in supporting this huge number of people on the planet is bound to basically start reducing our numbers. And a pandemic is an excellent example of that. There have always been pandemics in history. You know, we're certainly well aware of that. All of our ancestors made it through the Black Death, for example. But we've never been so numerous, nor have we ever had such fast communication for the way we travel and the way that we trade. And as a result, well, used to be that a flu virus, new one, would take a year to circumnavigate the globe. COVID-19 made it around the world in a month. That gives you an idea of the speed. And it's also, you know, we have viruses all the time, and usually they're just kind of annoyances that make us sick for a little while. This one, though, has evolved to the point that we can't get rid of it so easily because it's very stealthy. It sticks around it infects us for about 14 days before we know we're infected, so then we're infecting a whole bunch of other people. And because it's so new, nobody on Earth has immunity to it. You get in contact with it, you're going to get it. And so far that's happening on an exponential level. So because we keep thinking, okay, that's long enough, we're going to get back to work because we've had this exciting lifestyle that involves a lot of us getting out there to make a lot of money to push all those products around the world. We've been doing it prematurely, and COVID-19 just keeps leaping in, taking advantage of that. We don't know yet where this is going to stop.
And you taught at the University of Arizona, and now that institution and many like it are struggling with outbreaks of COVID-19. Universities as we knew them may have to close for a time and may never be the same. What do you see happening with higher education?
Well, I honestly don't know. I don't think any of us knows yet. You know, I live in northeastern United States now, and this is the home to many of our finest and oldest liberal arts colleges. And they were already dealing with financial struggles because after the big post-World War II baby boom, baby boomers were highly educated, and fortunately, women who started demanding their own rights back in the 1960s, and the women's movement has steadily grown, and it's well known to demographers that anywhere in the world where women get educated, they tend to have fewer children because they've got something interesting and useful to do with their education. And it's very hard to do when you have seven kids. So on the average, an educated woman is going to, anywhere in the world, rich country or poor country, and as I discovered researching Countdown, regardless of religion, I went to many Muslim countries and Buddhist countries, and you name it, they're going to have two children or fewer. You know, even Catholic Italy, you know, that has one of the lowest birth rates on the planet because they have one of the highest rates of graduate education among women. So all that has resulted in a smaller population pool for these schools, which means less money coming in. And now they're being hit by COVID, and I think that some of them probably are not going to survive. Online learning is one useful way of keeping it going, but it, as we all know, either for the experience of kids that we know or from our own experience, and it's pretty limited. It's not quite the same. The University of Arizona right now is doing something that I find appalling. They have palled up with one of these for-profit colleges to basically, you know, try to glom onto a student pool that they didn't have access to before. Many of them are United States military veterans, and the college that they are pairing up with has one of the sleaziest reputations. It's not far below Trump University, so it remains to be seen how that one turns out. I think basically education is scrambling at the moment. When it comes down to it, when the pandemic finally dies down, because so many of us get it, or they actually do come up with a vaccine, even though that will take quite a while. You know, pandemics usually historically last 2-3 years. There will still be education, because there will still be a need for education. But our institutions may be simpler. You know, the original, what we call today universities, were a bunch of people meeting, sitting underneath a tree outside. And I don't know. Stay tuned.
Yeah. Outside education.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock, and my guest is American journalist and author Alan Weisman. I'm Alex Smith. So now, the United States is at the point of gunfire and death in the streets from competing political movements, and watching from any other country, we have to wonder if civil war is likely in the dis-United States, and will the November election be the trigger? Do you have any ideas on that, Alan?
Well, I have more emotions than ideas about it. I'm deeply saddened to see what has happened in my country. This was not necessarily completely out of the blue. In the 1930s, Sinclair Lewis, a novelist who went on to win the Nobel Prize, wrote a book called It Can't Happen Here. In that book, he postulated a fictional second-term election. FDR was running against a populist candidate on the other side who was such a buffoon, everybody thought he was a clown. Does this sound familiar at all? Nobody took him seriously until he won. And things melted down from there. And I reread the book after Trump got elected, and it's it was just astonishing how prescient it was. I think right now the president who is trailing in the polls is going to do everything he possibly can to foment fear and chaos and even violence. He thrives on chaos. He always has, you know, partly because it's much easier to break things than it is to make things and build things. And he hasn't built anything other than that horrifying wall across our southern border, which I've traveled down to see, and it's pretty scary what has been done, and just the amount of water that has been wasted to create cement footings 10 foot deep for that thing across the Arizona desert. But, you know, he basically feels that polarizing the country and getting a lot of people scared is his best chance at getting elected. And there's something to be said for that, because all of the demagogues, and we have a lot of them in the world right now. We've got Modi in India, and we've got Xi in China, and we've got Putin in Russia, and we've got Orban in Hungary, and we've got Erdogan in Turkey, and Duterte in Philippines, and Bolsonaro in Brazil. And I cite that list because just to give a sense of how global this movement is. And it's a movement based on fear. People are afraid for a couple of reasons. In a hyper-crowded world where there are not enough resources in other places compared to some of the really blessed, economically blessed countries like Western Europe or North America, well, people in those less endowed countries, you know, it's a biological truth. You know, organisms will always move towards resources. So people in those places, and I don't exclude Canada here, get frightened when they see or they fear that the hordes are going to descend upon them and try to take away their comfortable lifestyle or to compete for it. As you know, poor people have successfully competed for so many jobs just in Western Europe alone. So that's one thing. The other is climate change. Everybody on Earth, whether they deny climate change or not, knows it's going on, and it's scary. So a fearful populace is one that is always ripe for some leader to come in and say, don't worry about it. They're just trying to steal what's yours. I'm going to take us back to a glorious time when we all had what we deserve. And they deny climate. And it's completely illogical that people who are fearful and desperate don't believe anything if someone in authority tells them it's going to be just fine. And that's how these demagogues have held on to power. Now, at a certain point, enough people realize that this has to stop. I'm hoping that my country reaches that point and is able to overcome all of the fraud and outright theft that is going to be perpetrated upon the polls and also from outside influences. Russia has a major stake in keeping Trump as the president, and in some ways the United States has become a Russian satellite over the past 4 years. So this is going to be a battle royal. It already is, and we're only 2 months away from finding out who's going to win it.
Yes, you mentioned climate change. Greta Thunberg just warned humanity's wasted another 2 years avoiding real action. California's been burning and on fire, as we all know. The city of Phoenix just hit 50 days in a row of 110-degree temperatures, over 43 degrees C every day. And people with homes damaged by Hurricane Laura are praying for more rain just to cool off because it's 100 degrees plus there with no power and no air conditioning. So it's strange, Alan, that we give hurricanes names but not heat waves, even when heat kills more Americans than all the other forms of extreme weather put together. I wonder, is something more dangerous when we don't give it a name?
No, I don't think it's any more or any less dangerous. I think the reason that we don't name heat waves is that, you know, a hurricane is a definable thing. You can, you know, see its, you know, its leading edge, and you can, and after it passes over, you can tell when it's gone. A heat wave, you know, it's invisible. Suddenly the temperature just climbs. But in the case of Phoenix, as you just described yourself, you can't tell when one stops and the next one starts. All we do know now is that because we have, you know, pick your metaphor, we've packed the atmosphere with insulation, or we simply thicken the glass on the greenhouse, but there's much more carbon dioxide out there than there has been in human history. And that means the entire history of Homo sapiens. And we are going to have warmer weather and more violent weather. And we can't say specifically that one day or another is going to be cooler or warmer, because there's a bunch of variables, and sometimes they're crashing into each other, like a heat wave and a hurricane. But what we do know is that temperatures are going to keep rising for quite a while, even if we stop burning all carbon-based fuels tomorrow. Some of this stuff just is still out there, and it's going to remain out there in the atmosphere, and it's going to remain there for a long time before the seas can safely absorb it all. And even when the seas absorb it all, that's going to create another question, another problem, because the seas are going to just be that much more acidic. So we're going to have things like wildlife die-off, plankton die-off, but other plankton will leap in there and flourish, plankton that is more acid-tolerant. You know, one thing I learned from doing the World Without Us is that as badly as we can batter the planet and have the, you know, we've had five major extinctions, when some of them up to 90% of everything alive died, life is this amazingly powerful and creative force, and it always bounces back, taking advantage of empty niches, filling them with something new and surprising, and ultimately very, very beautiful. And it will continue to do that. Now, whether the bounce back from this particular extinction that we are perpetrating and the what we've done to the climate is part of what's causing that to happen, whether that newly organized, newly balanced environment and weather regime allows our species to keep existing or not, we don't know. But, you know, it's something that we shouldn't take chances with.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Alan Weisman. So as an author, you have a long gestation period. Your major bestseller, The World Without Us, was published in 2007, Countdown in 2014. So another 7 years later, are you working on something new?
Well, I am, except unfortunately my research was kind of interrupted this year. I had four different trips planned to finish my research. I had already been on the road for about a year. And I was headed into Africa, Southern Asia. There was one trip to Northern Europe and one to the South Pacific for it. And instead, I'm home here in Western Massachusetts working in the garden. So my publisher is kindly being very patient. It's a book that they say they really want to have happen, and so we're going to see if a year's delay makes it possible for me to finish up my field research, or if not, we just might have to take on a different format.
You taught journalism, and I wanted to ask, the print publishing business, books, magazines, and newspapers continue to slide down financially and laying off staff, except for maybe a few exceptions for Trump exposés. Are we losing something valuable, or are we changing into a new model of citizen journalism on social media?
Well, we are losing something valuable. I don't think it's lost yet. I just think that it's in crisis. Citizen journalism is extremely useful. It has proven to be wonderful that people who are very alert suddenly take a video of a policeman in my hometown, Minneapolis, kneeling on top of somebody's neck. But citizen journalism has its limitations. When you study journalism and later on when you practice it, you realize that it is a craft that involves a lot of training. I remember once I was giving a talk at Microsoft, and somebody said, you know, I was talking about the crisis of print journalism and suggesting that Microsoft and Google and all these places should be subsidizing local sources of news henceforth, because all their web pages, Google News, et cetera, stuff like that, they look really nice and slick, but they're only as profound as the depth of the reporting behind them, real reporting. And some engineers said, well, do we really need real reporters? If anybody with a cell phone with a camera in it is a journalist? And I said, so what do you do here at Microsoft? And he said, I am a senior software engineer. And I said, so let me guess, you were this homeless guy on the street and Bill Gates just walked outside one day, plucked you off the street and made you a senior software engineer. He says, no. He says, you know, I had to be trained to do what I do. I said, well, don't you think that a journalist has to be trained to learn how to not just observe something be in the right place, but also how to adequately cover it, how to interview enough people who are witnesses to know, you know, what really happened, how to go into the history and to verify and to double source everything to make sure that what they're hearing is the truth, and how to realize that the real important news in this world doesn't happen in dramatic events like a car accident or a shooting, but it happens in between dramatic events, and that's where investigative reporters are ferreting out stuff for us. And he says, oh, yeah, I never thought of that. So, yeah, that's the answer. I mean, what's heartening to me is that even though journalism is in crisis, there are more students in journalism schools than ever before. Young people get it. They know that the world is in crisis, and they know that it takes trained witnesses to tell the rest of us what is happening and to be able to argue it in as convincing a way that when the buffoons try to deny it, you can stand up to them. And enough people, we hope enough thinking people exist that will be able to sway public opinion in the right direction. By the way, I am happy to say that although newspapers have been taking a hit, book publishing is doing extremely well. There's, and I mean print book publishing. For one, you know, people right now during a pandemic, they're doing a lot of reading. And for another is that, you know, e-books are, you know, they have a really great place. And since I travel a lot, I can carry, you know, 12 books with me or 100 books with me inside of an iPad. But there's nothing like the feel of a page turner, and people still like turning those pages. It's sort of like what I said at the beginning of this interview. You know, you can live inside of a building all your life, and you can work inside of it, but then something sends you out into nature. Maybe you didn't even intend on it. And suddenly you're standing under a tree, and you realize, wow, I feel good. And that's because the tree is doing things to the air, it's doing things to the temperature, it's doing things to the moisture level that your body responds to, because after all, we're still mammals and nature still rules on this planet.
Alan Weisman, I think you've just given us a clue, but where are you searching for hope?
Well, interesting you ask. I mean, the book that I'm working on is about what are our realistic hopes in the coming difficult decades, because we are facing, you know, we're facing multiple crises. We're facing the prospect of moving beyond a limit where we know that we have a chance at slowing down inexorable changes due to what we've done to the climate. We know that we are in the throes of another major extinction event. We know that our population right now is so big that it's perpetrating that event by pushing other species off the planet, literally, because we need their habitat for growing food. And the more we encroach on their habitat, the more we end up getting infected by their diseases. So these are multiple problems. What gives me hope is that I find people all over the world who know much more about this than I do. They know how bad the situation is. They're like the NASA climate modelers I've spent time with, or the biologists I've been spending time with, or the social workers I've been spending time with, the psychiatrists who are trying to visualize what it's going to be like when there is mass hysteria as systems break down in cities, and how to best prepare for that. The people who are dealing with the fact that there are more refugees on this planet than there have ever been in human history, and that number is expected to double in 5 years. All of that, and they still show up because they know that that's the right thing to do. And what else is there to do anyhow other than to keep trying? And you put on top of that all the young people, you know, like the 300,000 people, young people I marched with in the streets of New York City to hear a 17-year-old, she was barely 17-year-old, Greta Thunberg, like a Joan of Arc, hold everyone's attention riveted and command everyone's allegiance to the idea that there is still something to hope for.
Wild. You talk about Joan of Arc here, and I was fascinated to read your piece or to follow your piece on the rise of Christian power in South Korea, where it was the land of Buddhism. And we need a new vision, and we need to all embrace this to create a more positive future. So I'm wondering, do you think, Alan Weissman, we can create and transmit this grand survival vision in time without religion?
You know, why would we do it without religion when religion is one of the many tools that we have to do it? I may not be a particular believer in anything that resembles an organized religion. I don't attend any. But I recognize the fact that 90% of the people on this planet are believers, and so many of them, you know, they look to the leadership of the church or the mosque or the synagogue. If we raise the consciousness of those leaders, then we have a chance of reaching many, many more people. So, you know, one thing, if there's anything I've learned in this life, is that if you want to try to raise everybody's consciousness to believe in what you think is the truth, or even what you know to be the truth, before we can affect change, you know, this whole place is going to be trashed long before we can do that. But if you can convince people that their way of thinking embraces some of the things that we all need to know, such as an ecological consciousness. And in both my last two books, The War Without Us and in Countdown, I talk about religious leaders who recognize that in their own way, in their own religions, you know, just as we keep our mosques and synagogues and churches beautiful places, you know, we want them to be pure temples to receive the Holy Spirit, and we do the same thing with our bodies. You can't be drunk all the time and have a clear religious vision. So we are taught, you know, like particularly in the Eastern religions, you know, to take care of your body through things like yoga. You know, this planet is also a temple that in every major religion I know, from indigenous America to the Hindus, who have a whole pantheon that resembles nature of animals, I mean, it's recognized that this planet is a gift to us, whether it's from nature, from God, from gods, goddesses, whatever it is, it's one that we have been given, and there is an implicit understanding that we want to maintain it just the way it was given to us. That's a spiritual responsibility that's recognized in many religions, and one of the things that we can do is to find the leaders in those religions to help carry that message across to the masses who look for leadership.
So, Alan, as we wrap up here, is there anything else that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
Well, there's a lot of despair going around. There's a lot of fear going around, including in each and every one of us. But there are these places that we can go to. And for some, it's meditation. And for others, and sometimes for both, there's those trees I was talking about. Go take a walk. Go outside. Go to a city park. Go into the woods. Go hiking. Go be at the shore of a lake or at the shore of the ocean. Breathe it in. You will feel something that will feel extremely familiar and extremely eternal. And you will feel like, you know, this isn't going to end after all. You know, it's going to go on. Whether humans get to be a part of it, we don't know. But in the meantime, we are a part of it. Let's live it to the fullest. Let's replenish ourselves by going back to that natural source. And then, like those people I described to you who inspire me so much, let's give it our best. You know, let's keep trying to make this last as long as it possibly can, so long that the next generation gets to enjoy it too. And if they do, then maybe the generation after that as well. You know, a lot of people consider the human race, I hear this, you know, we're some kind of cancer on the face of the earth and the earth will shake us off. We've done a lot of bad things here, but we deserve to be here as much as any other species, as long as we don't do untold harm. And I would like to see my species, every species eventually goes extinct, just like everybody eventually dies, but I don't want to see mine go extinct prematurely any more than I want to see any other species go extinct prematurely.
Save the humans. We have been speaking with American journalist and best-selling author Alan Weisman, and in my show blog at ecoshock.org, I will put some links to follow up on our earlier interviews, on Alan's books and his radio pieces, some great radio pieces he's put out. Alan, thank you so much for staying in touch.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be back. Take care of yourself. Stay safe.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I really appreciated talking with Alan. When it all seems too big to understand anything, we all count on hearing from people with a focus, with a specialty for the facts. Weisman really did use a deadly virus as a way there could be a world without us. His thought exercise and all the research he poured into it still tells us a lot about who we are and where humans must not go if we are to continue as a species. As he said, his 2007 book was translated into many languages and provoked conversations around the world. I know his new book will do the same. But all that is coming back again as we experience the virus, climate change, existential doubt, and a longing for reconnection with nature. Here is a short clip from my 2007 interview with Alan Weisman just after his book, The World Without Us, landed in the public arena. Remember, you can listen to all my past programs absolutely free, all the interviews, from the Radio EcoShock website at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening again this week and caring.
As a journalist, I have covered the environment, covered a lot of other things too, for the past 25 years that I've been a working journalist. And it turns out lately, nearly all stories have an environmental component because the environment impacts everything. And I've seen a lot of bad things from pole to pole. You know, on the Antarctic side, I've covered the ozone hole. And I've been to burning rainforests. I've been to Chernobyl. A lot of this stuff is, you know, is in my book. The reason for writing this book was to try to find a way that we could look at it clearly without feeling so downright overwhelmed or frightened or depressed that, you know, who would want to pick up this book other than a few people who are, you know, already grimly concerned about the environment and we're just simply looking for more affirmation or more evidence. I posed a, we could call it a fantasy. You just referred to it as devious, and I don't have too much problem with that, I suppose. But it's not like I am deceiving readers, because I'm very clear about it in the beginning. We're going to try a little experiment here. Instead of worrying about, oh, are we all going to die, I just propose that something's already killed us off. This is in the very beginning of the book, that, say, some Homo sapiens-specific virus picks us off. You know, for example, what if AIDS were airborne and blowing around rather than just passed by fluids? Or, say, there were a rapture that took us away either by a religious figure or by space aliens, or, you know, some evil genius concocted something that sterilized us all. But something that very quickly would eliminate human beings from the Earth. And yet the readers get to stick around and see what the future is, or at least get a very educated speculation on the future at the hands of all these experts who I talk to in so many different places, in so many different settings. It kind of disarms the fear factor and disarms, at least temporarily, the guilt factor of, you know, what it is that we're doing, because we're no longer here anymore. And it also clears us away, clears all our distractions away. I mean, I clear away the walls that separate us from nature. In the beginning of the book, our houses go fairly quickly, and even our cities. And then we could see how the rest of nature would flourish without our daily pressures. And also, what have we left behind that nature would still have to contend with? Could it wipe out all our traces? And that includes the topic you brought up, what we have left in the atmosphere, but also all the stuff on Earth, ranging from our radioactive materials and our nuclear plants and our plastics and our pesticides, those kinds of things, to also some of our beautiful things, our architecture, our artwork, our manifestations of, you know, our spirit. What of humanity might last, might actually be immortal? So, you might call it devious, but to me, it's a really different way of looking at the world, and it seems to be working because, frankly, this book is a bestseller in several different countries now, and it's coming out in more and more languages, and that means that more than just the environmentally aware are picking it up to read it, because they are intrigued by a fresh way of looking at the planet.
And it is indeed an intriguing book. And thank you for talking with us. We have been talking with Alan Weisman, the author of The World Without Us from HarperCollins. Thanks so much for sharing your thought-provoking work.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Radio EcoShock.
I think we've already entered the era of superfires, both in Canada, continental U.S., Australia, and other areas as well.
Continue up to, you know, that 3.5 and some say 4 and indeed 6 degrees. The essential thing is this is ultimately, it's not compatible with human existence. That's the raw and the ugly truth of it. And that's why we really do need to do something about it.
Most of the world's airports, in many respects, are at sea level. You find airports everywhere along the coasts of the continents. Countries that can build airports out into the ocean. San Francisco did this. Japan does this. China did it. Honolulu. It's just the number of airports have landed in Sydney where you're just skipping the ocean and then you're on this tarmac. All of those are going to get covered over by even the 3 to 5 foot sea level rise because of storm surge.
Climate change is like the many-headed hydra. We think we know it, but we don't. The Earth is rearranging in all the places humans don't look, at sea, at the poles, deep in the melting permafrost, and in the farthest forest and mountaintops.
as long as I'm in this sinking ship and I have a can, I'm going to start bailing and keep working in that direction.